Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractors Business Tape of the Month. This monthly cassette tape series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of helping the service contractor come to a place of maturity and profitability. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry shares dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. Today's contractors are pushed to the limit. If it isn't the tech with a problem, it's the customer, supplier, or someone in the office. We start the day running and often end the day late at night, exhausted, thinking about how it's all going to begin in the morning. If you haven't done it already, take some time to ask yourself why you do what you do. It's not unusual for the urgent things of life to squeeze out the important things of life. Most contractors went into business as a way to support their families, but all too often the business becomes their life. This month's tape is very different. After 89 months of business tapes, we felt like it was time to reflect on what's really important in life. This month's tape is the true life story of Frank Abagnale. Many of you are familiar with Frank from his book, Catch Me If You Can. As a teen, Frank was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. This is Frank's true story. As exciting as his life may have seemed to have been, he paid a great price to find out what was most important in life. We want to give special thanks to Frank Abagnale for allowing us to use his life story as this month's tape. Now, let's listen to Frank.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be here this afternoon. Of course, I was standing here 2 years ago at your convention, but going through a bunch of slides and giving a seminar, which I'll be doing this afternoon. But I was asked if at the luncheon today I would take a moment and just talk about my previous life. People seem to always have a lot of interest in that. As you know, a book was written, and of course Disney out here in Hollywood is now making a movie about my life, and I don't have anything to do with that, but people have always been fascinated with my previous life. For those of you not familiar with me, back in the 1960s, many newspapers used to write about me quite often. Some newspapers for many years simply just referred to me as the Great Imposter. The New York Times wrote a syndicated column about me. The New York Times wrote about me for about 5 years in a weekly column. The New York Times, like the FBI, really didn't know my identity, so the New York Times was just fond of calling me the Skyway Man. The Wall Street Journal summed up my career a number of years ago and said that probably I would go down in history by far the world's greatest con man that ever lived. I earned all of those reputations when I was 16 years old. I successfully impersonated an airline pilot for Pan American Airlines for 2 years until I was 18. At the age of 18, I became the chief resident pediatrician of a Georgia hospital where I practiced medicine there for about a year. Don't laugh, I'd have been a gynecologist, but at 18 I didn't know any better. At the age of 19, having never been to law school in my life, I took the state bar exams in the state of Louisiana. I passed the bar and became a licensed attorney. Before my 19th birthday was over, I was appointed the Assistant Attorney General of the state, where I practiced law in that position for about a year. At the age of 20, I was a college professor at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. I taught two full semesters there as a PhD. Mormons haven't quite got over that yet, but they're still working on it. And, of course, before I was old enough to drink, before actually reaching my 21st birthday, I was a millionaire twice over, having cashed over $2.5 million worth of bad checks in 26 foreign countries and all 50 states in the United States. Last year I thought about running for Congress. A lot of people say, you know, a lot of people say, you know, I've seen you on Johnny Carson many, many times, and I have, of course, read many stories and articles written about you over the years, but what I've never understood is why did a 16-year-old do these things, and most of all, how did a 16-year-old ever get away with the things you got away with? Well, you know, I can't say that I came from the slums. On the contrary, I came from an extremely wealthy, very politically powerful family raised just north of New York City in Westchester County, New York, in a little town called Bronxville. I was educated by the Christian Brothers of Ireland in a private Catholic school where I went from kindergarten to high school called Iona, where I attended school there until about the 10th grade. By the time I had reached my 16th birthday, an IQ of 140, almost a perfect photographic memory. I was one of four children in the family, the so-called middle child of the four. My parents, after 22 years of marriage one day, decided to get a divorce. Unlike most divorces, where the children are usually the first to know, my parents were very good about keeping that a secret. I remember being in the 10th grade when the father walked in the classroom and had the brother excuse me from class. I remember riding with the father down to the county seat in White Plains, New York, where he kept telling me I would meet my parents. I remember walking up the steps of the stone building that afternoon that said family court, not really understanding what that meant. I'm sure looking back, my parents thought they were going to have the time to sit down and talk with me, but when I arrived, court was already in session. When I was ushered into the back of the immense courtroom, my parents were standing before the judge. The judge looked up and saw me at the back of the room, so he motioned me to approach his bench. When I walked up to stand between my parents, he just looked at me for a moment and went back to read his papers. A moment later, he looked up and told me that my parents were getting a divorce. In shock, I looked at the judge and looked at my parents. He went on to explain that under New York State law, because I was 16 years of age in a court of law before a presiding judge, I had to tell the court which parent I wanted to live with. I started to cry, so I turned and ran out of the courtroom. Judge called for a 10-minute recess, but by the time my parents got outside, I was nowhere to be found. My mother never saw me again for 7 years until I was a young adult. My father, unfortunately, never laid eyes on me again, ever. In the mid-1960s, running away was a very popular thing for young people to do. Unfortunately, a lot of them got caught up in Haight-Ashbury, the hippie scene, and the drug scene. Instead, I took a few belongings from my home, packed them in a knapsack, and boarded the New Haven and Hartford Railroad and took the 30-minute ride down to Grand Central Terminal in New York. My father owned a business in Manhattan, located on the corner of 40th and Madison. Like all of us, we had to work in the business in the summertime. So since I was about 12 or 13, I made deliveries for my dad on a bicycle that had a big box in the front of it all over Manhattan in the summer. I knew the city quite well, so I started looking for the same type of work. There are a lot of signs on the windows, stock boy, delivery boy. I'd walk in and apply. So tell me, young man, how old are you? 16. How far did you go in high school? 10th grade. I'll hire you. And I went to work for a few hours a day for a small amount of money. Soon realized I couldn't support myself on that amount of money, and that probably the only way anyone would consider giving me more money or more hours is if I was an adult and not a teenager. Well, at 16, I was 6 foot tall. I've always had a little gray hair since I was about 14 years old. My friends in school used to say that when we had to wear a suit, I looked like I was in my late 20s. So I decided to lie about my age. In New York, we had a driver's license at 16. Back then, it didn't have pictures on it. It was just an IBM card. I altered one digit of my date of birth. I was actually born in April of 1948, but I dropped the 4, converted it to a 3, made it 1938, and walked around and applied for the same type of work, only this time as a 26-year-old. People paid me a little more money, gave me a few more hours, but even then it was difficult to make ends meet. One of the few things I had packed in that knapsack when I boarded the train was a checkbook. I had a checking account off a small bank in Mount Vernon, New York, with a couple of $100 in it, mainly for school books and supplies. Had a couple of... there's the fire alarm. Had a couple of... checks in the book, and I would every so often write a check to supplement my income, $10, $20, the money was there, the checks were good. But it was my friends, my peers, who used to say to me, you know, Abagnale, you're the only guy I know walks into a bank in the middle of Manhattan. You have no account there. You don't know a soul. You walk in, you talk to somebody, and they cash your check. Well, my checks are good. That might be, but if I walked in that bank, they wouldn't touch my check with a 10-foot pole. You walk in, they don't bat an eye. Years later, reporters would write and speculate and say that that was my upbringing. Mannerisms, dress, appearance, speech enabled me to get away with that. Whatever it was very easy to do. So consequently, when the $200 ran out, I kept writing those checks. And of course, those checks started to bounce. My father had a great deal of political influence over New York politics. He had the police making a very special effort to find me as a runaway. That and the bad checks, I thought maybe it was a good time to start thinking about leaving New York City. But I was quite apprehensive about going to Chicago or Miami. Would they cash a New York check on a New York driver's license as quickly as they did in Manhattan? I was walking up 42nd Street one afternoon, 16 years old, pondering all of that. About 5 o'clock in the evening, I started to approach the front door of an old hotel that used to be there called the Commodore Hotel, now the Grand Hyatt. And just as I was about to get to the front door, out of the revolving door stepped an Eastern Airline flight crew onto the sidewalk. Couldn't help but notice them, the captain, the co-pilot, the flight engineer, about three or four flight attendants dragging their bags across the sidewalk to the van that was waiting at the curb. I thought to myself, that's it. What a perfect front. If I could pose as a pilot, I could travel all over the world for free. And I probably could get just about anybody anywhere to cash a check for me. So I walked up the street a little further to 42nd and Park, where stood the 55 floors of the Pan Am building. Pan Am, the nation's flag carrier, the airline that flew around the world. I thought, what a perfect airline to use. So the next day, I placed a phone call to the executive corporate offices of Pan Am. When the switchboard was ringing, I had absolutely no idea what I was going to say. When they answered, Pan American Airlines, good morning, may I help you? Yes, ma'am. I'd like to speak to somebody in the purchasing department. Purchasing? One moment, please. Clerk came on and said, yes, sir, maybe you can help me. My name is John Black. I'm a co-pilot with the company based out of San Francisco. You know, I've been with the company about 7 years, but I've never had anything like this come up before. What's the problem? Well, we flew a trip in here last night, 24-hour layover. We're continuing to London this afternoon. Yesterday, I sent my uniform out through the hotel to have it dry cleaned. Now the hotel and the cleaner say they can't find it. Here I am with a flight in about 4 hours and no uniform. Well, don't you have a spare uniform? Certainly, back home in San Francisco, but I'd never get it here in time for my flight. Well, now you understand. This would cost you the price of a new uniform. Oh, I understand. Hold on, I'll be right back. Well, my supervisor says you need to go down to the well-built uniform company on Fifth Avenue. They're our supplier. I'll call them and let them know you're on the way. They'll take care of you. Well, that's exactly what I wanted to know, so I went down to the well-built uniform company. Little fellow, Mr. Rosen, fitted me out in the uniform. Back then, they were gabardine, very expensive, the three gold stripes on the arm of the co-pilot, the gray hair. I certainly looked old enough to be the pilot. When he was all done, I said, how much do I owe you? Well, the uniform's $286. I said, no problem, I'll write you a check. He said, no. I can't take any checks. Oh, well, I'll just pay you cash. No, I can't take any cash. Need to fill out this computer card. Up in these boxes, put your employee number. Then we bill this back under uniform allowance. Comes out of your next Pan Am paycheck. That's even better. Go ahead and do that. So I don't know, paid for the uniform, but out the door I went. In New York, there were two airports, LaGuardia and Kennedy. LaGuardia, of course, 20 minutes from Manhattan. Kennedy, about 50. Naturally, LaGuardia being the closer of the two, that's where I went. Spent most of the morning walking around LaGuardia in the uniform, trying to figure out, now that I had this uniform, how the hell do you get on these planes? Well, I got a little hungry about lunchtime, so I walked in the luncheonette in the terminal, sat down at the counter, ordered a sandwich. Moments later, a TWA crew walked in. Flight attendant sat in the booth. Pilot sat up at the counter on either side of me. Captain right next to me. Back before deregulation, airline people thought of themselves as just one big family. They didn't hesitate a moment to talk to each other, and the captain kind of leaned over. Hey, young man, how's Pan Am doing? Doing just fine, Captain. Just fine. Tell me, what's Pan Am doing out here at LaGuardia? Pan Am doesn't fly into LaGuardia. They only go into Kennedy. Well, I picked up on that right away. Well, we came into Kennedy, but we had a few-hour layover, and I came over here to visit some friends of mine. Matter of fact, I'm on my way back to Kennedy now, as soon as I get my check and get the hell out of here. Well, tell me, young man, what type of equipment are you on? Now, that completely threw me. Airline people have a lot of jargon for things, and one of them is they never call a plane or an aircraft. They call it equipment. What type of equipment you're on means what type of plane do you fly? Back then, a DC-8, a 707. Of course, I didn't know that, and I thought, what type of equipment am I on? Only equipment I'm on is this stool. He must mean what type of equipment's on the planes I fly. So I thought, well, they have the wings, and they have the engine. They always had a sticker on the engine, who manufactured the engine. So I turned and said, yes, General Electric. All three pilots kind of just stopped eating and leaned over. Captain said, oh, really? What do you fly? Washing machines? And I knew I said the wrong thing. Out the door I went. Everybody had an airline ID card, a plastic laminated card, much like a driver's license, yet without that ID card, the uniform was worthless. I went back to Manhattan pretty discouraged, thinking, where would I ever come up with a Pan American Airline corporate ID? I was sitting in the hotel room going through the Manhattan Yellow Pages, looking under the word identification. Well, there were three or four pages of companies who made convention badges, metal badges, plastic badges. And I started to call around, and finally one company said, listen, most of those airline IDs manufactured by Polaroid, 3M company, data check, you need to call one of them. Finally got the 3M company on the phone in Manhattan. Yes, we manufacture Pan Am's identification system, along with a number of other carriers. How come? So today I'm a purchasing officer for a major U.S. carrier, and I'm in New York just for the day. But we're getting ready to expand our routes. We're going to hire a lot of new employees, and we're going to go to a formal ID. We're very impressed with this Pan Am format. Wondered if I could come by your office today just to discuss quantity and price. By all means, come on by. So I went by dressed in a suit, and the sales rep opened the books. They go to United, Delta, Eastern, Pan Am. I said, yes, we like this Pan Am format. Think you might have a sample I could bring back? Sure, I'll be right back. And he brought me back a 5x7 glossy piece of paper with a picture of an ID card printed in the middle of it. Someone else's picture was in the picture. John Doe was the name. And in bold red ink across the front, this is a sample only. I said, no, I'm afraid this won't do. You know, I need to bring back an actual physical card. By the way, what is all this equipment right here? Oh, now, we don't just sell these cards. We sell the system. Camera, laminator, cutter. Oh, we have to buy all this. Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, since we have to buy it all, why don't you just demonstrate how it works and use me? Fine, have a seat right here. Draw a picture and made up the card. As I was going down the elevator, I was studying the card, but it had a blue border up at the top, about a half inch, in Pan Am's color blue. But that was it. Not a single thing on the card said Pan Am. No logo, no insignia, nothing reflecting the card was Pan Am's card. Now, this was a plastic card, like a credit card. You couldn't type on it. You couldn't write on it. You couldn't print on it. And if you tampered with the plastic, you destroyed the card. Well, I discouraged. I put it in my pocket, headed back to the hotel. But as I was walking back, I noticed I had passed a hobby shop. So I stopped and walked in. Excuse me, sir. I see you sell a lot of models here. Uh-huh. You sell models of commercial jetliners? Sure, right over there. And I bought a model of a Pan Am 707 cargo jet for about $2.40. Took it back to my room, opened the box, and threw all the parts out. But there at the bottom of the box were the sheet of the decals that went on the model. And when you soaked them in the glass of water, that little Pan Am logo that would have went on the plastic tail slid right off onto the top of my plastic card. And the word Pan Am and their special styling of graphics went right across the top of the card, and the clear decal on the laminated plastic made a beautiful identification card. Pan Am says they estimate that between the ages of 16 and 18, I flew close to 2 million miles for free. Pan Am says I was in some 83 countries. Pan Am says keep in mind that though Frank Abagnale did in fact pose as one of our pilots, to the best of our knowledge, he never once stepped on board one of our aircraft. Of course not. I was always afraid that if I did, someone might say, you know, I'm based in San Francisco, been there 22 years, but don't recall ever meeting you before. You must know so-and-so and so-and-so. Or someone might say, you know, your ID card is not exactly like my ID card, so instead I flew on everybody else. If I wanted to go somewhere, I just walked out to the airport, United Flight 800 to Chicago. Then I walked downstairs through the door marked United Operations and walked in the Pan Am uniform. The operations clerk would look up, hey, Pan Am, what can we do for you? So I wonder if the jump seat's open on 800, need a deadhead to Chicago. Jump seat? Yeah, it's open this evening. All right, let me get a pink slip pass, will you? And I'd give him my ID and he'd write me out a pass. I'd walk out, hand it to the flight attendant. She'd open the door to the cockpit and I'd step in. They had a captain, a co-pilot, a flight engineer, and a seat directly behind the captain called a jump seat where pilots deadhead on company time. Now, because pilots love to talk shop, once you picked up that jargon, it was the same conversation over and over and over again. I would just step on board. Even gentleman Bob Davis be arriving in Chicago. Have a seat, Bob. On the taxi out, always the same question. So, Bob, how long you been with Pan Am? I've been flying about 7 years. What position you fly? Right seat, which is airline terminology for a co-pilot's position. What type of equipment are you on? Had that one down. Perfect. Matter of fact, whatever they flew, I didn't fly. So I had no problems with that. Then when we'd arrive in Chicago, I would get off the United flight and walk up to the Pan Am ticket counter. Closest I like to come to Pan Am people. Agent would look up and see me. So can I help you? Give me, where do we lay over here? I had the deadhead trip in here for someone got ill, never laid over in Chicago. We use the Parma House Hilton downtown, sir. Catch the crew bus on the lower level, door 3 up. I go down to the Parma House Hilton and check in. On the corner of the registration desk, there would be a little sign that says, Airline Crews, register here. I'd sign in, show my ID, they'd give me a key, I'd stay 2 or 3 days, and Pan Am would be direct billed for my room and my meals. But I also could cash a check there, usually up to $100, because I was an employee of the airline. The airline had a contract with the hotel, and they would, as a courtesy, cash your personal check up to $100. But then I found out that every airline honors every other airline employee's personal check, a reciprocal agreement still practiced today in 1994. Out at LAX, an American flight attendant can walk up to the Delta ticket counter, write a personal check for $100, show her American ID to Delta, and Delta, as a courtesy, will cash the check. and vice versa. Of course, when I found that out, I'd go out to LAX, only I went to everybody, Northeast, National, KLM, Air France. It would take me a good 8 hours, stopping at every building, every counter. By the time I got all the way down around where Frontier was at the other end, at least 8 hours had gone by. And what do you have in 8 hours? Shift change, new people. I'd go all the way back around this way. Made a great deal of money. The only reason I quit at the age of 18 is the FBI issued a John Doe warrant for interstate transportation of fraudulent checks, a federal offense. The John Doe warrant meant the FBI didn't know my identity. Both the New York Times and the FBI estimated my age to be at approximately 30 years old. So the FBI put out a warrant looking for a 30-year-old. I thought it was time to hang up the uniform. I moved to Atlanta, Georgia, into a very swank singles complex that was just built there called the Riverbend Apartments. On the application for the lease, there were many questions. One of them was occupation. Well, I began to write down airline pilot, but the next question said employed by, supervisor's name, phone number. I thought to myself, pretty classy place. They might pick up the phone tomorrow, call Pan Am personnel in New York, verify employment. I'll have to come up with something that would be impossible to check out, yet something that would justify why I drive an expensive car, wear expensive clothes, and don't work much. So I wrote down the word doctor. First thing came to my mind, filled it in. Had a very inquisitive apartment manager, said, oh, I see you're a doctor. Yes, ma'am. What type of doctor are you? Well, I'm a medical doctor. However, I'm not practicing medicine right now. I left my practice in Los Angeles, come to Atlanta to invest in some real estate holdings I have. Won't be practicing for about a year. How interesting. Well, tell me, what type of medical doctor are you? I figured being a singles complex pediatrician should be pretty safe. So I moved in, Dr. Frank Williams, pediatrician. Now, everybody called me Doc. Always a typical question. So, Doc, where'd you go to medical school? Columbia University in New York. Oh, where'd you serve your internship? Our Harper Children's Hospital, out in L.A. Once in a while, when the guys would come over, hey, Paul, what's up? Hey, Doc, look at my leg. I don't know what I did to it. Look at this. Paul, I can't examine your leg. You need to go to your own doctor and have him look at it. Oh, okay, I understand. When the girls came by, I always gave them a thorough examination and sent them on their way. I was young, but not stupid. I was living there for about 2 or 3 months. Everything was going great. One afternoon, there was a knock on the door. Opened the door, a very distinguished gentleman standing there, about 55. Yes, sir, can I help you? Yes, you are Dr. Williams? Yes. My name is Gordon. Just moved in the apartment below you. Wanted to come up and introduce myself. Ah, new neighbor. Come on in. Well, I'm not only a new neighbor. I understand you're a pediatrician. Yes. Oh, colleagues. I'm the chief resident pediatrician of the hospital up the street. Next morning, I started to pack. But then I thought, no, I'm not going to run. Been living here, breaking no laws, bothering nobody. I'll just avoid this guy. But Dr. Gordon loved to talk. Every down the way, the tennis court, out to the pool, out to the car, he'd stop you. After a minute about the weather, he'd start talking about medicine. Not being able to speak medical terminology, I in turn would cut him short. But I knew eventually he would get suspicious. Determined not to move, every day I went to Emory University's medical library from about 8:30 in the morning till about 3 in the afternoon. Every day I made it a point to read the daily journals, knowing no doctor could keep up a practice and read the journals every day. Every day I took certain articles on pediatrics and memorized them in part. And every single night at 5:30 when Dr. Gordon pulled into his parking slot of his apartment, I was on his step every night. Hey, Doc, hear about this new theory they're using up at Mayo? Oh, what is it tonight? And I'd follow him into his apartment. He'd go in the bedroom to get undressed. I'd go in his bedroom and sit on the bed talking. Be in the kitchen, I'd follow him back and forth. Go to the bathroom, I'd talk through the door. Pretty soon he'd come home. Hey, Doc, I don't have time to talk to you right now. I got to go. Guys started to avoid me. Well, one afternoon he came over and said, you know, we're opening a new hospital in Marietta, suburb of Atlanta. It's a new county hospital. I want you to come to the opening day. I said, sure, I'll be happy to go. Went up to the hospital, spent the entire day there. I met orderlies, nurses, department heads, administrators, doctors, and when I left, not a soul there didn't believe I was Dr. Frank Williams, pediatrician from Los Angeles, who just wasn't practicing. Well, that was fine, except I started to date one of the nurses I met there. And every so often, I'd go pick her up. She was working a little late. I'd sit in the lobby and wait for her. I was sitting there one evening when here comes the hospital administrator, who is not a physician, but the administrator of the hospital. Dr. Williams, I cannot believe you're here. Just got your home number from Dr. Gordon. Was on my way to my office to give you a call. Wonder if I could have just a moment of your time. Certainly. I don't know how to ask you this, but Dr. Gordon says you'd be more than happy to help us out. What's the problem? Well, on the midnight to 8 shift, I have a resident. He supervises a number of interns and nurses on his ship. He's just been notified of a death in his immediate family. He's returning to the West Coast tomorrow for about 10 days. Now, Georgia law requires a resident on duty either be a full practitioner or a specialist. I have neither. With the shortage of doctors in Atlanta, us being a new hospital in the suburbs, without working triple shifts, I don't know what to do. Dr. Gordon suggested you being a pediatrician, you easily could cover the shift. I see. I tell you what, I'd be more than happy to do it, and I certainly have the time to do it, but you see, I'm not licensed to practice medicine in the state of Georgia, just in the state of California, where I hold my residency. All the red tape for 10 days. Oh, no red tape. Bring it before the medical review board tomorrow morning. They'll issue a temporary certificate. You can start tomorrow night. Oh. Now, being one who hates to pass up a challenge, I couldn't help but give it a shot. The next thing you know, here I was 18 years old, smock on, stethoscope in my pocket, don't know which end you stick where, supervising this shift. Now, a lot of people say, you know, of all the things you did, the doctor had to be the most difficult. On the contrary, the doctor was probably one of the easier things. I remember the first night the nurse stopped me on the floor about 2 a.m. Doctor, I know you haven't done this in school days, but when administrating the shift, have to write your observations in the charts before the conclusion of each shift. Ah, yes, the chart. I left them for you at the nurse's station. Well, I'd opened the charts, but I couldn't read a word. I mean, you have to see the way these doctors wrote, couldn't make out a letter. I thought if I came along in nice penmanship and wrote something that didn't make a lot of sense, they'd know I was a phony. So I would just scribble for about two or three lines. I didn't write a word. I'd just scribble along. Then I'd sign it. I figured if they called me the next day or questioned me, I just wouldn't come back. But nobody ever called me. Nobody ever asked me what I wrote. Now, the interns loved me because I was the only one that ever let them do anything. The nurses didn't like me too much because, well, I was always chasing these little candy stripers. But they were my age. The nurses were too old for me. Nobody understood that. I was there about 9 days when the hospital administrator told me the man I was relieving had resigned and would I mind staying on till they could find a replacement. Figure what the hell, I'd already been there 9 days, why not? Stayed there 1 year, 12 months, 5 nights a week. No one ever doubted for a second I was not a doctor. On my own, I resigned and left. Years later, the New York Times would go back and write about all the things I did, somewhat in a sarcastic way, but they did bring out some good points. They said, take Georgia, for example. Abagnale knew under Georgia law, under a temporary certificate, he was not permitted to diagnose, administer drugs, treat patients, or even examine them. Georgia law is explicit that under temporary certificate, one may only administrate the people below him, and Abagnale knew people very well, and he knew enough about medicine to make it work. He's right. In the year I was there, I never laid a finger on a patient, never diagnosed, just strictly administrated a shift. I left there and went to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, because the Attorney General's office was looking for lawyers. Now, I figured if you can be a doctor, you certainly can be a lawyer. The reason I picked Louisiana is no one required a law degree. All you had to do was take the bar. If you passed the bar, you were a licensed attorney. Louisiana was then, is today, and always will be the only state in our country who chooses to practice their law under what is known as the French Napoleonic Criminal Code of Procedure. The New York Times says, fact of the matter is, had Abagnale been a Harvard graduate of law, he would have had to study the code to be successful in taking the bar. I took the code, studied the code, took the bar, and passed it. I was licensed under the name Bob Conrad. I worked for then Attorney General P.F. Grimion in the Civil Division of his state court, where I tried civil cases for the state for about a year. No one the wiser, I resigned and left. I went to Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. They were looking for a professor of sociology, Ph.D. Wasn't difficult. Read one chapter ahead of my students. They never knew the difference. The only problem was being a Catholic trying to impersonate a Mormon, which caused me a lot of problems. But a lot of people say, yeah, but now you also became a very famous thief. Even today, you're the only teenager still ever put on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, the one and only. Well, a lot of people say that the FBI overclassified me because I did a lot of things that just never been done before, and that drew a lot of attention. I was walking down a Chicago street one day, counting five $20 bills I had in my pocket. It's all I had. But as I was counting them, I noticed I had passed the front door of a bank. So I stopped. I thought to myself, I'll go in this bank and I'll open a checking account with this $100. I'll give them this phony Pan Am ID for identification. In 2 weeks, they'll mail me 200 checks with this name. And with this ID, I'll be able to cash those checks anywhere. So I walked in and opened the account. New accounts person came back, so here's a receipt for your $100. These are some temporary checks. We'll be mailing you your printed checks in about 10 days. And I couldn't help it. I was always inquisitive. You know, excuse me, miss, I notice here that you didn't give me any deposit slips. No, sir, they come from the check printer. Be in the back of your checkbook, print out your name, your address, and your account number, and you'll get those in 10 days. I see. And if I wish to make a deposit, say, tomorrow or next week, not a problem. So you see that table in the lobby? Has all those forms on it. Just go over there and help yourself to a blank deposit slip. Write your account number in I gave you and use those till you get your printed ones. So I walked over and took a big stack of them off the shelf. Nobody cared, went back to my hotel, couldn't sleep. kept staring at them on the dresser. When the morning came, I said to myself, I wonder. So I bought some magnetic ink, the ink banks used to encode account numbers on checks and deposit slips, and I encoded my account number the bank had assigned to me the day before on the bottom of every one of these blanks. I then went back to the bank, put them on the shelf in the lobby, and everyone who came in put their check directly in my account. Had about $40,000 at the end of the day. Needless to say, I made a withdrawal. I was at the Logan International Airport in Boston. I was trying to catch a flight. It was about 11:45 at night. I had ran out to the airport. The whole airport was closing. Ticket counters, rent-a-cars, gift shops. Walked up to the ticket counter. Excuse me, sir. You're closing the airport? Yes, sir. Like San Diego, the Boston airport lies right in the heart of the city. All jet operations shut down at midnight. Noise abatement control. Next flight out is at 6:30 in the morning. I sat down wondering what to do. I noticed all of them sticking their cash and receipts in these big bank bags. Then they'd zip them closed, lock them, put them under their arm, and walk out to the bank terminal where I had the bank in the terminal. They'd stick their key in the night box, open it, drop the bag down the chute, make sure it went all the way down, closed it, locked it. One right after the other, Hertz, Avis, Delta, Eastern, Dobbs House, walking up, dropping the bag. Well, I didn't give this a lot of thought, but I came back to the airport the next night about 11:45. I had rented a bank guard uniform from a costume store in Boston. I had a big dolly with a container, and I bought some press-on letters at an art store and put the name of the bank on the side. I hung a beautiful sign over the night box that said, "Night box out of order. Please leave all deposits with guard on duty." Everyone did. I was the guy sitting there going, how the hell can a box be out of order? I mean, that's like a mailbox without order. People are dropping the bags. I used to kite checks, only I kited them for a great deal of money. And, of course, in the old days, we had the kite, the front, the sting. And the sting, of course, is where a con man makes a profit. And the front is where a con man spends a great deal of money creating what he calls an image or a front. In the old days, a good front cost about $50,000. Took about 10 weeks to create. Once in place, of course, the sting. And always could make four times back whatever it was that cost you to make the front. Back then, of course, I rented the penthouse suite of the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami. I lived there at $600 a day. At least a Rolls Royce with a chauffeur, wore the most expensive clothes money could buy, and tipped only $20 bills. To the 1,100 employees of the Fontainebleau, I was Alan C. Scott, multi-millionaire stockbroker in his early 30s from California. That's exactly what I wanted them to think. But I must have overimpressed the general manager of the Fontainebleau, for one afternoon he stopped me in the lobby. "Mr. Scott, I know you're very busy. Could I have a moment of your time?" "Certainly. Your Honor, one of our distinguished guests, Mr. Alan C. Scott. Mr. Scott, His Honor, the Mayor of Miami, Mayor King." May was there to give a luncheon speech. We spoke for a moment, turned to walk to the elevator, old-time gruff politician. "Mr. Scott." "Yes, Your Honor." "Giving a private dinner party at my home tonight, black tie affair. I'd like you to come as my personal guest." "Why, thank you, Your Honor. My chauffeur will give you the directions." 8:00, I pulled up at the mayor's home in the Rolls Royce, the tuxedo, started mingling with the crowd, when I noticed this beautiful blonde sitting up at the bar. She was gorgeous, about 24 years old, obviously there alone, and every so often signing autographs for the guest. One of the servants came by. "Excuse me, I never go to movies, and I absolutely never watch television. Is that an actress?" "Oh, no, sir. Cover girl. Been on the cover of Cosmopolitan, Vogue, 17, Glamour Girl, you name it. Some say she's probably become the most successful model ever to come out of Florida. Would you like to meet her?" "So I'd love to." And I was introduced to Cheryl. Cheryl was very impressed, thought I was 32, very wealthy. Asked me if that was my Rolls Royce outside. I said, yes, one of them. And we talked on till about 2:30 in the morning, and Cheryl had a few drinks. And finally I said, "Look, Cheryl, how would you like to go back to my place at the Fontainebleau and have a nightcap?" I said, "You know, Mr. Scott, I've always wondered about men like you." "Beg your pardon?" "Well, I mean, I always wonder what it would be worth to someone like you to take me back to your place for the whole night." I said, "Well, I have no idea." And being 19, I had no idea either. She said, "Well, why don't you make me an offer?" I said, "Well, I don't know, Cheryl. $300? "Oh, I don't think so." "Well, look, Cheryl, you know, I'm a little novice. How about if I double it? $600. "I don't think so." "Well, look, Cheryl, we could be here all night dickering about the price. Why don't you forget about coming to my place for the night? Why don't you just take me to your place, say, for an hour? And I'll give you $1,000 cash in advance, up front, for an hour. That's it. Let's go." So we got in the Rolls Royce, got back to our hotel, got up to her room. It was about 3:30 in the morning, and she started to open the door, and I very politely leaned over in the hallway. "Excuse me, Cheryl, that you go ahead in, I'll be right back." She jumped up, grabbed my arm. "What do you mean you'll be right back? Where do you think you're going?" "Well, I don't carry $1,000 in my pocket. I'm going to go downstairs, cash a check, I'll be right back." "You mean to tell me you don't have this cash with you?"
Well, no, but you think this hotel's going to cash a $1,000 check at 3:30 in the morning? You're not even a guest of this hotel.
Well, this isn't just a check. This is a cashier's check from the Chase Manhattan Bank in New York. Just like gold, they'll cash it.
Let me see.
This is a cashier's check. Why don't you just endorse it over to me?
Well, I couldn't do that.
Why not? This check is for $1,400. We've already agreed on $1,000. So Cheryl gave me 400 change. We both got screwed that night. Needless to say, Cheryl doesn't take checks anymore. And to this day, I wonder whether I was worth the 400 or not. You know, like any criminal, sooner or later you get caught. I was no exception to that rule. I was arrested just once, right before my 21st birthday, by the French police, who apprehended me in a small town called Montpellier in southern France. Taken into custody, the French government said I had forged checks there. They would prosecute me and punish me before they would consider giving me to any other country requesting my extradition. They did just that, convicted me of forgery, and sent me to prison. I served my time in a place called the Maison d'Arrêt, house of arrest in a little town called Pepignan in southern France. The prison was built in the 17th century, so it had no plumbing, no electricity, and no heating. Built of stone, when you arrived in the building, you were stripped of your clothing. You were taken to what they call the cell, probably about the size of a tool shed, 5 feet by 5 feet by 5 feet. Bread and water for breakfast, bread and soup for lunch, bread and coffee for dinner. And, of course, when they fed you, they had a little door they opened on their side, put the tray in, and when their side closed, your side unlatched, so you really never saw the food. You ate it. And, of course, I was there for 6 months, which felt like 6 years. I went from 198 pounds to 109 pounds, caught double pneumonia there, and almost lost my life there. On the last day of the 6 month, I was taken out of the prison cell and turned over to the Swedish police and extradited to Sweden. Later charged with forgery in Sweden, I was convicted and sent to a Swedish penitentiary in Malmö, Sweden. After serving a sentence there, I was turned over to U.S. federal authorities, who brought me back to the United States. The French prison was quite a harsh place. Disney, of course, spending $35 million to make a movie about my life. And though I'm not involved in that movie, I understand that the writers have sent scouts to France because they wanted to shoot some exterior shots of that building. They assumed the prison had closed, but they were informed that the prison was open, operating the same way it always operated. Minister of Justice has allowed Disney to shoot their scenes in the cell I was in, as long as, of course, they did nothing to change the cell. And though there are some people who would like to criticize their prisons, Americans could take a great lesson from the French. I served time there. We spend about $20,000 a year to house an inmate in this country. 68% of them return to prison in less than 6 months. In France, they spend less than $500 a year to house an inmate. Less than 1% ever go back once they've been there. Having served time in the French and Swedish, I was brought back to the United States and finally convicted in a U.S. federal court. The U.S. federal judge who sentenced me was Judge Newell Edenfield, the Chief United States District Judge. Judge Edenfield said, "You know, Mr. Abagnale, very difficult sentence for me to impose." He said, "Obviously, you committed all these crimes as a juvenile, so there are those who argue that I should treat you as a youthful offender. Obviously, first offense, you've only been caught once. French took you into custody. You served time there. You served time in Sweden. And all I would be doing, I guess, is sending you to prison the third time for the same thing. So some would argue that maybe I should send you on your way. Probation, time served." Of course, $2.5 million is a lot of money. And I've decided that I was going to waive your rights as a juvenile and try you as an adult. I sentenced you to 12 years in a U.S. federal penitentiary. You know, I am probably the only one always amazed by people's fascination with my life. I was just a teenage boy who ran away from home, got into a lot of mischief. I was capable of getting away with a lot of things because I was an extreme opportunist who happened to be in the right place at the right time. But I was, of course, always smart enough to know that I would never get away with it forever. When I came out of prison, I was ashamed of what I did, felt it was something that should never be discussed again. But the media thought otherwise. Books were written, movies will be made. People have always had this fascination. So I would not like anyone to leave here and think that that's my understanding of what I did. You know, I was a very gifted child. God gifted me with the greatest father that any little boy could ever ask to have. In life, there are lots of fathers, but there are very few daddies. It takes a very, very special man to be a daddy. They are far and few between. My father was a daddy. He loved his children more than he loved life itself. He was a daddy because he told his children every day of their life he loved them, not only physically, but verbally as well. What I remember growing up most in my house, there were four of us. Every night at bedtime, my father, 6'3", would walk around to each child's room, drop down on one knee, give you a kiss on the cheek, and give you a hug, and whisper in your ear, I love you very much. Same routine, night after night. He never missed a night. Some nights he came home late, you fell asleep, but you always woke up in the morning and somehow knew he had been there the night before. What I remember vividly is my older brother moved in my room as he got older. He eventually joined the Marines. He was 6'4". Yet when he came home on leave, my father would walk around to his bed, hug him, kiss him, whisper right into his ear, I love you. You were never too old. When I was 16 years old, like all children, I needed my mother and my father. I want you to understand one thing. All children need their mother and their father. There are no exceptions. All children need their mother and their father. And I will tell you that there isn't a man or woman alive today who can look me in the face and tell me that they've experienced a divorce between their parents and that they're over it. Never gets over it. No matter how strong-willed that individual is. One day, a complete stranger, a judge, told me of the two people I loved most in the world, I had to choose one of them over the other. He gave me seconds to answer him. Instead, I turned and ran. I have no regrets. I would do it again tomorrow. I've never made that choice. I would never make that choice, and no child should ever be asked to make that choice. But how could I tell you it was glamorous? I cried myself to sleep till I was 19 years old. I always get amused by these articles and my exploits. I lived it. I used to think it was ironic that I could fool the world and I was believing I was a doctor to crawl into a bed in an apartment every morning and cry myself to sleep. Because no matter how much I fooled the world into believing I was an adult, I was just a kid. I missed my dad. I missed my mom. Missed my sister. Missed my brothers. Never got to go to a senior prom, high school football game. Never even got to share a relationship with someone my own age. Oh, I always knew I'd get caught. The law sometimes sleeps. The law never dies. It's just a matter of time. I was caught. I went to some very, very bad places. And 25 years old later, I'm not ashamed to say that I still wake up in the middle of the night thinking about them, and I do not go back to sleep. While I was sitting in that French prison, my father climbing the subway, 55, very physical, athletic man, as he did every morning, tripped on a step. When he reached back to grab the rail, he missed it. His head hit it. When he landed at the bottom of the step, he was dead. I didn't know he was dead. I was not there to see him placed in the ground. And most of all, I never got to tell him how much I loved him. That's my biggest regret of all. I was very fortunate because I was brought up in America where they always are willing to give somebody a second chance. There are many, many financial institutions and companies in this room who have used my services over the last 19 years, including the U.S. government, who I owe a great deal to, 800 times more than I could ever repay for the opportunities it's given me these past 18, 19 years. But about 19 years ago, in a grocery store in Houston, Texas, a young girl decided to become my wife. I was stocking groceries. I didn't have a dime to my name. I told her I had been in prison and that anyone could send me back to prison at any time. Yet she became my wife anyway. She changed my life. She gave me three beautiful boys who today are 15, 12, and 10 years old. They're my life. They're my heart. They're my soul. They're my being. Everything I have, everything I've achieved, every success I've had because of the love of a woman and because of three little boys who have a great deal of respect for their daddy. Through this, I've learned two things that I would like to leave you with. There comes a time in all of our lifetimes when we come to that final realization that there will never, ever be anyone in your life, not your children, not your wife, who loves you more than the people you call your parents. No one. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. If they're still here, you tell them you love them. You give them a hug. You give them a kiss. And to those many men in the audience, I'm afraid that this is a lesson most men never learn. And I'm afraid that this is a lesson that most men learn when they're 50 years old, but should have learned when they were 18. I happen to think it would be quite a world if upon graduation from high school, a young boy learned this lesson. That success has absolutely nothing to do with money. Being a man has nothing to do with achievements, skills, professions, nothing. There's only one thing that makes a man, and that is that he loves his wife. He is faithful to his wife. He is loyal to his wife. And that next to God, he takes his wife and his children, and they become the most important thing in his life. You show me this man, and I don't care what he does, who he is, what he's been, and I'll show you a real man. I've done a lot of things in my life, but I assure you I have done nothing greater, nothing more rewarding, nothing more worthwhile than simply being a good husband, a good father, and what I strive to be every day of my life, a good daddy.
Next month, it will be back to business. However, it's our hope you will go back to the office tomorrow with a new perspective. Over the past 15 years, Tom Grandy, founder of this tape series, has seen contractors across the country invest their time, energy, and money into their businesses, often to the exclusion of everything else. Then, one day, the contractor makes it to the top. They have created a very successful business. They have won numerous awards, been written up in trade journals, and have been recognized by their peers. The problem with all too many successful contractors, however, is that they paid a very dear price for their success. Often, it has cost them their spouse, their children, and sometimes even their health. We are all called to excellence in every area of our lives, but be sure to keep your priorities in order. Determine what is really important to you, and then take a good hard look at how you are going to rearrange your life to be sure what is really important becomes your number one priority. As always, we welcome your feedback on each month's tape. Feel free to give us a call with your comments, or if you prefer, you may fax or email our office. Better yet, check out Grandy & Associates' newly designed website. Our address is www.grandyassociates.com, and it's also printed on the tape insert. Again, our website address is www.grandyassociates.com. By the way, don't forget to sign up for Grandy & Associates' new 3-day program called the Basic Business Bootcamp, designed for trades company owners and managers. The program is held monthly at our offices and involves 3 days of intense business training designed to teach contractors all the basics of labor pricing, cash flow, service agreements, collections, and monthly tracking. The tuition includes the latest version of Grandy & Associates' industry-leading software program called Labor Pricing for a Profit with Cash Flow Projections, which each contractor uses to model his or her company throughout the 3-day program. Call for a free 4-page brochure with all the details. Each class is limited to 15 contractors, so call soon to reserve your spot while space is still available. The Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.